In a lawless world, there's only one thing punks understand.
Go ahead. Make my day.
That's right. In the waters off the Horn of Africa, pirates are suddenly staring down the barrels of the Chinese Navy. Somali pirates making an emerging superpower's day. Geopolitics of the Indian Ocean, pirates of the Gulf of Aden. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 29th, and you're right. First, it was the German destroyers, and now it's the Chinese destroyers. And those Somali pirates may be in a bit of trouble there.
And they may be making China's day, I think, as a supercar. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, John. Also today, Israel continues its offensive on Gaza, and deficit estimates in the coming year, some say they are enormous. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
The Gaza conflict between Israel and Hamas could last for a while. Here's Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev.
Despite our very precise and effective strikes against the Hamas military machine, that machine remains both strong and dangerous. And this is going to take a few more days, if not longer.
It will take at least that long to determine how precise and effective the strikes have been. They have killed more than 300 Palestinians in Gaza. Civilians are among the dead, leading to criticism from Arab League Secretary General Amir Moussa.
Stop the violent actions and to stop the aggression against the Palestinians in Gaza. This is the time of ceasefire. This is the time to cease all hostilities in Gaza, of which the Palestinian people suffer.
He did not mention Hamas rocket attacks against Israeli civilians in towns along the border. They have slowed but not stopped. We'll have a report from the heart of Gaza right after the headlines.
And the Mideast turmoil is affecting oil prices. They've spiked in the wake of the fighting, nearing $41 a barrel around there, somewhere around there. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's defense team is playing offense today. He says he'll send the Obama transition team report to the state's legislature impeachment panel. The report said no Obama staffers had inappropriate conversations with the governor. Meanwhile, the Illinois Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn told CBS's Face the Nation that Blagojevich won't last long.
The 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth is February 12th of next year, and I don't think Governor Blagojevich will be governor at that time.
What's he smoking? We will see on February 12th. We'll have him on the show, I think. Politics isn't the only problem in Illinois. There are other weather worries. Warm-up is actually bad news in Illinois. Emergency crews are on standby for flooding once snow and ice from last week's storms melts. In Michigan, high winds knocked out power for hundreds of thousands, and there are also winter storm warnings from the Northwest. Just one of the woes that the people of Michigan have to deal with. The Detroit Lions made history, the biggest loser in the NFL, 0-16. They've got to make a comeback. So what's your favorite comeback story?
One of the best comebacks we've had is after 9/11, the Patriots won the Super Bowl. I think that was pretty cool.
Tell us what you think is the best comeback, and it doesn't have to be sports. Call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Last week we did streaks, and a lot of people called us. Comeback stories. Vanessa Williams is one we already heard this morning. That was a great one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The escalation of violence between Israel and Hamas, the authority that speaks for the people of the Gaza Strip, is increasing today. And it's clear that in the most densely populated place on Earth, Israeli weapons are attempting to sort out military targets of Hamas from civilians. The casualties speak for themselves. More than 300 people killed, and a rocket fired from Gaza killed an Israeli man in the city of Ashkelon. One of the questions this morning is how much of this response is a domestic Israeli issue in the middle of an election campaign, and how much is an attempt to substantively move in a military way a longstanding stalemate between Hamas and Israel. Joining us now is Ethan Bronner, who covers the Middle East for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, John.
First of all, there seems to be a lot in this in terms of historical context for both Hamas and Israel. First of all, the question of Israel needing to show for domestic consumption that it is tough on these rocket attacks of Hamas.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for domestic consumption, I think they would argue it's both domestic and foreign consumption, that there is a feeling in Israel. I mean, it's hard to distinguish between how people feel and whether it's a legitimate feeling, that Israel's deterrence has declined in recent years, that they particularly point to the fact that Hamas decided not to renew the ceasefire it had with Israel after the 18th or 19th of December, despite Egypt and Israel asking for it, the sense that Hamas felt it could continue to lob rockets with impunity. So there was a sense here that a deadly message needed to be sent.
Well, Ethan, I'm wondering if Hamas is possibly seeing an opportunity here in the sense that Israeli campaign against Israel in 2006 really, Lebanon established Hezbollah, raised Hezbollah's profile geopolitically in the region and in the world. And I'm wondering if Hamas sees a similar sort of opportunity here.
I think there's no doubt that Hamas sees it that way, that Hamas has, in fact, modeled its behavior in the last 2.5 years on Hezbollah, and, in fact, there's been very, very distinct and specific cooperation between them and also through Iran. And there's no doubt that the Hamas leaders feel that this could push them into a position of leadership in the Palestinian movement and, in that sense, in the Islamic and in the Arab world as well. That's certainly true. I mean, of course, there's a distinction, a difference of perception, again, between how Israeli military and political leaders see what happened in Lebanon and how many others see it. So the Israelis tend not to place so much faith in the notion of the street and the idea that people have lionized Hezbollah and will do so with Hamas. They tend to take the argument that force works with these guys and there's no other way to deal with them. And they tend to look at what happened in 2006 in Lebanon and say, well, it's been 2.5 years and not a single rocket has come across our border from there. We think our message got across.
How much of this response, Ethan, do you think has to do with the political situation in Israel itself when you have the Defense Minister Ehud Barak and you have Zippy Livni, the foreign minister, vying for leadership positions next year?
Well, I think it's a very legitimate question, Adora. I mean, I think it's difficult because the politics of this country are so on the surface at any moment that whether or not there's an election 6 weeks away, it seems to me that there is still an incredibly emotional political conversation that occurs all day long. And there's a huge amount of pressure on these guys to act. There's also an enormous emotional attachment to Gilad Shalit, the Israeli corporal who's been held for 2.5 years by Hamas in Gaza. And so they clearly are responding to the public. I don't really know whether, if this operation is quote-unquote a success, whether Livni or Barak gains more. I mean, Livni is the foreign minister, Barak's the defense minister. It's sort of hard to tell. So, but clearly there's a, it's very hard for them to go into this election campaign and feel that everyone views them as a bunch of wusses and they've got to take action.
Well, Ethan, certainly it's a cautionary tale if this were to unfold the way the Lebanon campaign did. I'm wondering if, regardless of the success of this military operation, is this once again perhaps a failure that a stalemate like this without talking directly between the parties can go on indefinitely without something exploding as we've seen over the last few days?
Look, it seems unlikely that it can go on for very long without something truly awful happening. I agree with you. And I think it's very dangerous ground they're walking on. On the other hand, from their perspective as the guardians of a country in which, thousands of rockets have flown in We mustn't forget that these rockets, over the course of many years, not many years, but some years, not much was done in retaliation. And there is a feeling that the less you do in retaliation, the more they do it. So they've taken this very, very definitive action now, in which they are sort of systematically destroying everything having to do with Hamas in Gaza. It does seem sort of unlikely that it's going to, you know, snuff out the flame of Hamas and of the Palestinian Islamic movement. But this is the action that they've chosen. They don't know how else to do it.
Right. I mean, and the next step, I guess, is will there be a ground campaign or not? And we'll know that possibly within hours. Ethan Bronner, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ethan Bronner, New York Times correspondent, speaking to us from Gaza.
Now we turn to South Central Asia, where over the weekend, Pakistan observed the one-year anniversary of the assassination of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Meanwhile, a highly unusual conversation took place over the weekend also between Pakistani and Indian officials following reports of Pakistani troop movements at the India border. For more, we turn now to Ambassador Munir Akram, the former permanent representative to the UN from Pakistan. So what do you make of these very unusual talks between the directors general of the military operations of India and Pakistan?
Well, these talks are not that unusual. They are supposed to take place periodically because under the structure of the composite dialogue which Pakistan and India have been conducting for the last 4 years, the director generals of military operations are supposed to have a weekly conversation with each other. But this has apparently been interrupted because of the Indian stance after the Mumbai bombing attacks. So this conversation ought to be taking place regularly, and it's a good sign that it's now resuming.
Both sides went to great lengths to say neither was taking aggressive positions. Why do you think they felt it necessary to make that statement?
Well, it is quite necessary because I think that any misunderstanding between India and Pakistan with the forces which are lined up on the border, there's over a million troops on either side. I think it's very dangerous if there is a misconception and a conflict or could be sparked off by accident. So it's very necessary for the two to keep each other informed and that there is no hostile activity going on.
Ambassador, it seems as though both the Indian leadership and the civilian Pakistani leadership on some level is a little nervous about forces within their domestic politics that might be pushing things towards a much more inflammatory stance in the post-Mumbai period here, and that at least I'm detecting personally a sense of very deliberate actions on the part of both of these nations' leaders to keep things from escalating.
Yes, of course, there are hawks on both sides. But it's obvious that any responsible leadership would want to avoid a conflict. A conflict will be very dangerous. It could escalate out of control. It would be also counterproductive in terms of addressing the problem of terrorism on both sides. And it would compromise the larger global effort against terrorism. So I think for all those reasons, it's important that the leadership in both countries cool things down, rule out the use of force, resume the composite dialogue between the two countries, begin to address some of the underlying issues, and begin to exchange information, evidence about terrorism on both sides, so that a measured and mature approach could be undertaken to address the problem.
Ambassador Munir, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Ambassador Munir Akram is a former permanent representative to the UN from Pakistan, and he joined us from London.
We've been talking about comebacks in light of the 0-16 start and finish of the Detroit Lions in the NFL. And we didn't mean just sports comebacks. Nancy emailed this comeback here. Four words, Marion Shapiroff Barry Jr. Marion Barry, after his drug scandal in 1990, he became mayor again in 95. Now he's still in politics, serving on the D.C. City Council. So for that matter, political comebacks. You got Winston Churchill.
That's a good one.
That's a huge one. Richard Nixon, even, for that matter. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A 0-16 start has the Detroit Lions thinking about comeback. At least, what would they do next year to top 0-16? What's your favorite comeback story for us? 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Does not have to be about sports. We've gotten some great political ones already. The shock and awe of the Iraq War was soon replaced after 2003 with the shock and awe of the cost of that war. And with the first comprehensive assessment of the ultimate cost of the Iraq War, were two heavy hitters from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Linda Bilmes, lecturer in public policy, and her collaborator, Joseph Stiglitz. Well, Bilmes and Stiglitz are back at it with a new report with some equally jaw-dropping numbers on the deficit that are expected to be a terrifying financial legacy from the eight Bush years. Linda Bilmes joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Kennedy School of Government. Linda, thanks for being a part of the program.
Thank you, John.
As you look at the 8 years of the Bush federal deficit, what is it that you're seeing and how does it compare with deficits in the past, even extreme ones?
It really is a staggering figure, John. Our national debt has risen from $5.7 trillion when President Bush took office to $10.7 trillion now. And it is going up even as we speak. If you count any of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac additional debt we've taken on, it's well over $11 trillion, which means that we have amassed more debt during the Bush administration than we did in all of the previous 42 presidents combined.
Wow.
Again, that sounds really depressing and awful, but how does the aggregate federal deficit manifest itself in terms of consumers? I mean, you've done some calculations and that, you know, I owe $9,000, all my kids owe $9,000 to somebody. How does that manifest itself on the U.S. economy?
First of all, in terms of our annual money that we spend, the annual budget, we have to pay interest on the debt that we owe. Considering that we already are spending about two-thirds of our budget on fixed costs like Social Security and Medicare and federal employees' pensions and veterans' benefits and other fixed costs, there isn't that much remaining for spending on discretionary items such as air traffic control and roads and highways and education and health research and education and so forth, and the military. There isn't that much. And essentially, we are crowding out spending on the things we really need because we have to pay so much interest on all of this borrowing.
And is this a consequence that the Bush administration dealt with during its tenure, or is it something that is going to handcuff the Obama administration as it attempts to look at some of these very issues you just named?
Well, the Bush administration made what I consider a series of really profound errors, which have led to this situation. First of all, they led two rounds of massive and very inequitable tax cuts. Secondly, they not only went into Iraq and spent nearly $1 trillion now, but they borrowed all of the money to go into Iraq. Third of all, they led a massive buildup in defense spending in things which have not benefited us at all, even in the wars we're involved in. For example, $80 billion on F-22 bombers, which have not flown a single sortie in Afghanistan or Iraq. And finally, they embarked on a number of very expensive, unnecessarily expensive new programs, such as the prescription drug benefit, which, while it may be a good thing, is far more expensive than it needs to be because we are not allowed to negotiate with drug companies to get a good deal on the medicines.
Of course, the really depressing thing is you're not even including all of the bailout stuff that's been the headlines for the last 6 months.
Right, not even including the bailout things, but just including things which are directly attributable to decisions that the Bush team made. And that alone has got us into a situation where we now are, our national debt has doubled. So when you think about how this constrains the Obama administration, we are now in a situation where we are facing the worst economic conditions partly as a result of these poor decisions during the Bush administration, where we are facing this very deep economic challenge. And in order to get out of that, we have to spend an additional large sum of money to stimulate the economy. So Obama is in a, you know, between a rock and a hard place, because he has to spend a significant amount of money and to go into even more debt in order for the economy to avoid going into a depression. And clearly, the objective of Keynesian economics is not to be spending huge amounts and racking up huge amounts of debt when times are good, which is what we've been doing. He is now forced to add to this debt.
So you're really suggesting that the Obama administration is going to have no wiggle room when you consider the costs of the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, as well as the hundreds of billions of dollars that is being talked about now to help stimulate the economy.
I mean, that's right, Eudora. I think that there is really a reduction in wiggle room. That's a key phrase, because we know that the costs of the Iraq and Afghanistan situation are not going to go down. In Iraq, one of the major findings of our research was that the costs of the war go on for a long, long time, for many, many decades. The cost of replenishing the military equipment, paying veterans' medical care and veterans' disability compensation, and paying interest on the money we've borrowed, that means that we will be paying trillions of dollars for decades, even if we draw down our troops.
Well, Linda, right across campus there at the Harvard Business School, there are a lot of economists who are saying now is not the time to worry about the deficit. What is the one key statistic that suggests to you that the deficit is really important in this time of a downturn before we go?
Well, the annual deficit, as opposed to the long-term debt, we can't worry about that. I mean, to sort of call worry, you know, we can't run economic policy, which is for the long-term security of the economy, by worrying about this year's deficit. So the result of that is that this year's deficit, which means the difference between how much tax revenue we have coming in and how much we spend, we are going to have a deficit of probably $1 trillion, maybe more. Well, we've never had a deficit like this. But there is no way to avoid that problem. But I think that the issue is that over the long term, eventually we will have to pay this debt back, and so we have to pay it back with interest.
$1 trillion. What's the interest on trillions of dollars? Linda Bilma is a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks so much for joining us. And Femi, okay, I won't ask you what the interest rate is on $1 trillion, but you've got some other headlines, I'm sure.
I certainly do. Thank you for saving me there. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Israel's attack on Gaza and Hamas continues for the third consecutive day. Targets included a building next to the Hamas's premier's home. Israel's defense minister says that it's fighting a war, and I'm going to quote him here, to the bitter end. More than 300 people have been killed so far. 140 police officers were killed in the line of duty this year. That's down more than 20%. Law enforcement support group says that it's because of better training. About half the deaths this year have been traffic-related. Only 41 were killed by gunfire, and that's the lowest total in more than 50 years. Five are dead and two US troops wounded after a series of bombings across Afghanistan. A suicide car bomber struck a governor's compound north of the capital, Kabul, and two other bombings in the southern province of Kandahar killed three civilians and wounded 21. That's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Well, their 0-16 season is now history. The Detroit Lions will have to see if they can't engineer an equally historic turnaround or comeback, which got us thinking about comebacks, and not just sports comebacks.
Hi, this is Jim Martorano from Yorktown, New York. The biggest turnaround and comeback probably is Barack Obama, who lost badly in a congressional primary and then could not in 2000 even get into the Democratic convention. Now is the president-elect and the leader of his party.
Tell us a great comeback story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
We're going to head over to East Africa, where Somali pirates have been grabbing headlines for months for hijacking tanker after tanker. The Somali government is in shambles and its president is resigning. But the snatch and get paid schemes of Somali pirates may be coming to an end. Last week, German fighter ships thwarted an attempting hijacking, and now China has sent two destroyers to escort and protect its merchant ships. Chris Hogg, a reporter for the BBC, is in Beijing covering the story, and we spoke with him earlier and asked him why China chose to send in the destroyers.
Well, it's interesting. I went to a news conference at the China Defense Ministry here in Beijing, and there the military brass who were on the podium were very clear. They said that there had been UN Security Council resolutions that had mandated the international community to take action, and that China saw it as an important part of its role within the international community to do its fair share. I think there are more interesting questions about what's really behind this. I mean, certainly one very important factor has been that there have been seven attacks against Chinese ships this year. Now, that's provoked a lot of chatter on the internet here in China, with netizens, as they call them here, complaining that China is not standing up to the menace of piracy. So certainly there was quite a lot of domestic pressure on the Chinese to take part in this kind of operation.
It's worth noting that about 60% of China's oil is imported from the Middle East. But in the past, Chris, we've heard arguments that you don't want to take on these pirates because it's too dangerous, particularly if you're talking about a tanker that's full of oil.
Well, there are two things to say about that. I mean, firstly, the Chinese were very clear. They're sending a lot of firepower with them. These two destroyers have helicopters with them. They have special forces. I think there are between 50 and 70 special forces that are part of this deployment, including one man who the Chinese media reported claimed he could kill the pirates with his bare hands. So there was certainly a lot of confidence as they were setting off on this. But you make a good point about the amount of oil that is imported here to China. The other reason I think that China is taking part in this kind of operation for the first time is that China is, of course, doing much more business with the rest of the world. So securing marine routes is now as vital to China as it is to other countries like Britain or America. So that's why you see this kind of more aggressive action from them that is quite unusual.
Well, Chris, maybe it's even beyond that. I mean, it seems like this is less about piracy and oil and much more about a real opportunity for China to project its power into the Indian Ocean as a prelude for doing what it's always wanted to do, really, in the past 10 years, say, to be the counterbalance to the United States in the Pacific. Do you see this as a first step for China projecting itself into the world's oceans?
Well, there are two ways of looking at that. I mean, first of all, there's the official Chinese line, which is a denial that this reflects any kind of major change in terms of foreign policy. And they were asked the question that you've just put at this news briefing a couple of days ago, and they were very, very clear about it. They said, you know, China's policy has always been a peaceful rise. It's always been about not trying to provoke its neighbors in any kind of way, and that policy hasn't changed. However, I mean, one thing that is interesting, and a lot of experts have pointed out, is that what we've seen really since the early 1990s is China slowly building up its naval power. Now, you have, for instance, mass production of frigates. Soon they'll be mass producing destroyers. And of course, once you build your Blue Sea Navy, it's easier to project your power. The thing that China lacks, though, is experience. It lacks the experience in terms of cooperating with other navies. It lacks the experience of operating far from home. China doesn't have any bases in the area. China doesn't have an aircraft carrier yet. And so You're right. This really does offer them a training opportunity, if nothing else, to see just how difficult it's going to be for them to operate far away from Chinese bases.
Very quickly, Chris, based on your read of the military officials that spoke in the last few days, do you see China more or less indefinitely patrolling the Horn of Africa and these particular waters?
Certainly, they were suggesting that this was going to be a long operation. Prolonged was the word they used. They are concerned, though, about how easy it's going to be to supply these ships and to keep them supplied. So I think we're talking weeks and months, but I think it's probably at this stage it would be too far to say that this was a permanent move.
But clearly a sign that 2009 is going to be very different in the way that China takes on an international problem as such as this.
Yes and no. I mean, the other problem that the Chinese have is that the Chinese economy is slowing down. Now, the Chinese economy slowing down will definitely focus the minds of the leaders here in Beijing, and it already is, on maintaining social stability. That could end up being the biggest test that they face in 2009. And inevitably, when things start to go wrong at home, they're kind of the other kinds of diplomatic or military adventures tend to get put to one side. So, I mean, certainly talking to analysts here in Beijing, that's what they think is going to be the biggest problem for 2009, keeping a lid on whatever problems there are domestically, rather than flexing their muscles, flexing the country's muscles militarily overseas.
Chris Hogg is a reporter for our partner, the BBC World Service, and he spoke with us from Beijing, China. Now we turn to Femi Oke with the headlines.
And the time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The Palestinian death toll is over 300 as attacks by Israel continue. Most of those killed are members of Hamas's security forces. The strikes seem to have reduced Hamas's ability to retaliate, and there's been one rocket fired back. It left one Israeli dead. The Illinois legislature meets today to consider impeaching Governor Rod Blagojevich. Now News, his lawyer, will submit the Obama transition team's report to their impeachment panel. The report said that no Obama staffers talked about the sale of the Senate seat with the governor. Blagojevich's lawyer says that helps his case. Somalia's president has resigned after 4 years in power. Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed made the announcement today. He said that he failed to gain full control of the country and didn't receive help from other leaders in shutting down Islamic militancy. And we'll hear more about that shortly from Martin Plaut, who's the Africa editor for our partner, the BBC. And there's a little less than an hour to go before the open on Wall Street, and the Dow looked headed for a higher open. I looked a couple of moments ago, it was up by about 40 points. And also, that's where I'm going to leave it for now. Ha! I was going to do one more story, but stay with me for 10 minutes' time, and I'll tell it to you
then. Leave them wanting more.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. The Somali president, Abdullah Yusuf, has announced he's resigning. Mr. Yusuf has come under increasing pressure since he tried to sack the Somali prime minister in a power struggle nearly 2 weeks ago. BBC's Africa editor, Martin Plaut, joined us earlier, and I asked him what Yusuf's resignation means for Somalia.
Well, you know, one can't be absolutely sure because Somali politics is so inscrutable. But essentially, I think what it means is that the transitional federal government, which has been in place for the last 4 years, has come to an end. I think, you know, it was never a very effective government. And, you know, I think with the prime minister having resigned, having the president having resigned, now the poor speaker of the parliament is sort of stepping in. You know, I think this is the end of the road, to be honest.
I mean, this is a country. It's lawless. There are a million refugees, violence is rife, and they've got a real problem with pirates.
This is absolutely true. I mean, all of those things. And I mean, the real suffering is with the Somali people. You know, at least a million, maybe a million and a half Somalis are just this side of starvation. I mean, they've had floods, they've had droughts, they've had wars, they've had everything you can imagine to be thrown at them. I mean, it is an absolutely appalling situation.
So who steps into that void, and what is the role of the international community?
Well, that is the $64,000 question, if people still use that phrase. You know, frankly, this was the last best hope. There have been at least 14 different attempts since 1991 to bring about a new government for Somalia. This was the last one. It took 2 years to be forged. It brought together all the factions in Somalia. They sat in expensive hotels in Kenya. And frankly, it was only when the Kenyans said, you know, either you decide now or you're not going to get anywhere. We're going to throw you out. We're going to stop paying your hotel bills. That in 2004, they finally came up with President Abdullahi Yusuf. And, you know, this has now failed, and we now have a void. The United Nations says they're not going in. The African Union has a pathetically small number of forces there, about 1,800.
Well, Martin, let's talk about the void. And you describe Somali politics as inscrutable. That's possibly generous, since from my perspective, it seems non-existent. The question really is, since the famine and since sort of the al-Qaeda lawlessness has emerged in Somalia, the failure of the village structure and any sort of tribal structure in Somalia has meant it's almost impossible to regenerate any kind of civic life there. What do you think would work at the ground level?
Well, one thing that might work is if people stop trying to intervene in it. You know, the United States has pushed the most unsuccessful policies in the region for a long time. You know, they first went in February 2006. They backed something for the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace and Counterterrorism, which effectively operated a snatch squad system. Trying to get some al-Qaeda members. They were paying apparently $1,500 a month. They then backed the transitional federal government against the Islamic courts. The Islamic courts were actually doing a fairly good job at that time. But, you know, and this policy has now just fallen to bits in their hands. The only thing the United States has actually done is put forces in Djibouti and occasionally used, helicopter gunships, special forces, A-130s to hit people that they thought were al-Qaeda.
So clearly none of those things have been effective. And the question for 2009 is going to be, what will work? Martin Plaut, thank you as always.
It's a pleasure.
Martin Plaut is the BBC's Africa editor, and he joined us from London.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 29th, and Femi Okeh has joined us with the headlines.
Thank you very much. I like that perky way you said, okay. 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Hundreds are dead, and the Israel-Hamas battle shows no sign of letting up. In fact, it could grow. Thousands of Israeli troops are on standby, which means a ground attack could follow days of airstrikes. More than 300 Palestinians have died. Hamas rocket attacks have slowed since the bombings, but some rockets are still hitting Israel. Oil prices are shooting up in the wake of the Middle East conflict. They've got a near the $41 a barrel mark this morning. That reverses a recent trend of falling prices. In world markets, European indices are mostly up at the moment. Asian markets close modestly higher. Guinea is now suspended from the African Union. The AU says that this will stand until civilian government is restored there. A recent coup brought a military government into control of the West African nation, and the coup leaders said that they will hold an election in 2 years' time. The Russian public have been voting for the greatest Russian of all time. Now, in a televised poll in Russia to nominate the top Russian, a man credited with murdering millions of Russians came third. Have a listen to the results being announced on TV.
Alexander Pushkin, Alexander Nevsky, Pyotr Stalin.
So did you hear Joseph Stalin's name there in the mix?
I love this story. It's great.
So top of the list was Alexander Nevsky. He was a 13th century Russian prince, saved Russia from invaders. Very good. Reformer Peter Stolypin, the prime minister to Tsar Nicholas II. He came in second place.
How did Pushkin do?
Pushkin was actually announced, but he was in the top 10. Oh, he wasn't one of the top ones, yes. And in third place, Joseph Stalin, the dictator. Responsible for the deaths of 20 million Russians. And Stalin was actually ahead for a while until producers begged people to vote for somebody else.
It's a complicated nation, Russia. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
So as Femi was reporting on the conflict between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Israel defense minister says Israel is fighting a war to the bitter end against Hamas and its branches. A third day of attacks has pushed the death toll in Gaza above 300, and there is a real question as to whether there is any end, bitter or otherwise, to the political stalemate between Israel and Hamas, or even if this escalation constitutes an opportunity for, say, Iran or even the new Obama administration. We're joined by Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and author of the book, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Aaron David Miller, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to begin sort of twofold here. The violence that has begun here came after Hamas apparently refused to renew a ceasefire arrangement in a diplomatic set of talks between Israel, Egypt, and Hamas, and it's unclear just how involved Hamas was in all of that. But do you think Hamas has stepped away from diplomacy deliberately here to test and see if they can have an outcome in Gaza the way Hezbollah had an outcome in Lebanon in 2006?
I don't think this really is a question of diplomacy or not diplomacy. I think it's an inevitable result of a relationship and confrontation between two parties, Israel and Hamas, whose objectives and strategic goals are simply mutually contradictory. And sooner rather than later, any period of quiet, the informal ceasefire, set of understandings brokered by the Egyptians, was going to come apart because neither of the objectives of either of these parties are being realized. The Israelis want quiet for their southern towns. They want the return of Gilad Shalit. Hamas has a revolutionary agenda, although there may be elements within the movement that are prepared to settle for a two-state solution. But they want the border crossings open, normalized, and regularized. They want to govern Gaza and benefit from the status quo, but also refuse to participate in any sort of diplomatic process with the Israelis, as their counterpart in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, who heads Fatah, or at least a good part of it, wants to do. So I think this was doomed to fail.
It was completely inevitable. Shalit, of course, is the Israeli who is being held by Hamas in Gaza, or believed by Hamas to be held in Gaza. Well, then, is this an opportunity for Iran, which is apparently the proxy of Hamas here? Or is it an opportunity for the United States to broker something that, as you say, is far more challenging than any of the other Arab-Israeli confrontations that have been brokered in the past over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, if this were an operation or even an environment in which violence or insurgency or war would produce a diplomatic opening, You might be able to argue, despite the all of the killing and the grieving that is currently underway, that there might have been some logic in this. But unlike other periods in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the period after the October War, for example, which led to the disengagement agreements and eventually the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, or the first Persian Gulf War, which led to Madrid, or even the First Intifada, which led to the Oslo Accords, I don't see the diplomatic silver lining here. I don't see the political initiative to follow a period of confrontation which would allow a unified Palestinian national movement and Israel to engage with one another. That's the real tragedy here. This is a crisis that doesn't appear to have an exit strategy into more positive territory. And that's why the Obama administration, sadly, is going to inherit this 100-year headache with very few options and very few levers to pull to either defuse this current crisis or to build on it and create some measure of opportunity.
Why do you think there is not any political roadmap out of it? Is it because Hamas is currently the leadership in on Gaza? Is it because Israel has its own political domestic politics, political situation going on? Is it because we're in the middle in the U.S. of going from one president to another, or is it a combination of all those things?
I think you've identified fairly and honestly several of the key factors. You have a divided Palestinian leadership and a Palestinian national movement in crisis. After 50 years, the Palestinians have not yet decided whether diplomacy or armed struggle is the way to attain their national aspirations. So you've got two polities, two armies, two negotiating positions, and two separate constituencies. Second, you've got an Israeli leadership that, despite their military power and effectiveness, is weak and constrained. There are serious divisions within Israel about what price should be paid in order to create a Palestinian state, what they want from the Palestinians, and what the Israelis are prepared to actually give.
Well, let's focus on some scenarios that might actually constitute levers to pull here. I mean, if you say that the first step here is a unified Palestinian front, is it conceivable that an Obama administration having direct talks with Iran for the first time could actually negotiate that as an initial step towards then talking to Israel on a unified basis about an overall resolution of the crisis?
Well, I think the sequence more likely would be, I do believe that a U.S.-Iranian relationship is important for a variety of reasons, including, in no small measure, the Arab-Israeli issue. But I think the sequence has got to be some measure of unity and coherence within the Palestinian national movement. The Obama administration, no great power, no outside power is going to somehow put the Palestinian Humpty Dumpty back together again. These are internal Palestinian decisions. They relate to ideology. They relate to the legitimacy and coherence of groups within the Palestinian national movement. If the Palestinians can't create a measure of unity, it seems to me the prospects for building any sort of serious negotiating process that could lead to a conflict-ending agreement are probably slim to none.
And the fighting will continue as that unity continues to elude Palestinian leaders and the bombs fall. Aaron David Miller is a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and author of the book The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace.
On a much lighter note, the Detroit Lions made history as being the biggest losers in the NFL. They've got to make a serious comeback. So what's a great comeback to you? What is it made up of?
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota, and I think the title of Greatest Comeback has to be shared by two American divas, Cher and Madonna. But here's the twist. I don't mean this as a compliment. These ladies are compulsive attention mongers who just have to have the spotlight. Okay, maybe not Cher. Fine, okay? I admit that I like Cher.
Another cry for help from our friend Troy in North Dakota. It's great.
We'd like Cher to hear your thoughts on comebacks from Marion Barry to Cher or Madonna. Who do you think has done a good job of turning things around? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
It's very hard for them to go into this election campaign and feel that everyone views them as a bunch of wusses and they've got to take action.
That's New York Times correspondent Ethan Bronner talking about Israel's ruling party as it wages an offensive in Gaza. We're always on here at The Takeaway, and if you missed anything, go to takeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
He's back, talking about the economy. William Seedman, remember him?
Well, I'm thinking we're going through the pain, you know. We're in that process now. We'll get over it, but we got the painful period to go through yet.
Apparently, there is very little pain these days for the former head of the agency that bailed out the savings and loan industry decades ago. Seidman and other bailout veterans are back in D.C. as advisors and dealmakers chasing $700 billion in new bailout money. What do you call someone who smiles when he talks about pain? A consultant? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 29th. Good morning, John.
I want to be a consultant. Good morning, Adora.
I know that's smiling in the face of bad news. Mm. However, the bailout is bad news for most people, but we will introduce you to some folks making big bucks off of it. And good news from New Orleans, thriving artists making a difference. We'll explain. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Yeah, they're making a comeback in New Orleans, but some Hamas landmarks in Gaza are now just smoking piles of rubble. New Israeli airstrikes knocked out Hamas symbols, including a security compound and a university building. Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa says Israel is also hitting innocent people.
This is a major operation against generally a civilian population in Gaza.
But Israeli President Shimon Peres says Israel had to strike because of rocket attacks on Israeli civilians.
To whoever asked us to stop shooting, they have to change the address. Let them turn to Hamas and ask them to stop shooting, and there won't be shootings.
Thousands of Israeli soldiers have been called up from the reserves. That means a ground assault could follow the bombings. So far, Hamas rocket attacks have slowed but not stopped completely. We'll take you live to Gaza's front lines right after these headlines.
Oil traders are watching the Middle East violence and don't like what they see. Prices have surged since Israel attacked, at times nearing $41 a barrel this morning. Today is the next round in the fight to stay in office for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. His lawyer says he'll submit the Obama transition team report to the Illinois legislature. A committee considering impeachment meets there today. The report said no Obama staffer talked about any sale of the Illinois Senate seat with the governor.
Winter weather will pack another punch today. Winter storm warnings in effect in the Northwest and in Michigan. Wind damage has hundreds of thousands without power. There are also flooding fears in the Midwest as warmer temperatures melt all the snow and ice from the storms last week.
Five Afghans are dead and two U.S. troops wounded after a series of bombings across Afghanistan. The attack on the troops came by suicide car bomb at a governor's compound north of the capital. This as the Pentagon prepares to send more troops to Afghanistan.
Wall Street will get started in less than a half an hour. The Dow was up about half a percentage point on Friday, and the S&P gained about the same amount. It starts trading at 872. Lackluster trading expected this week. The futures show a positive but basically flat opening. So the Detroit Lions ended their season as they began with no wins, a 0-16 season. That's bad. What kind of a comeback do you need to follow that? That's what we're talking about. Comebacks. They don't have to be sports comebacks. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
An actor who made it back.
Made a great
singer,
comeback.
Songwriter made it. A politician, Marion Barry. Someone suggested 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Perhaps it's futile, but we at The Takeaway are always looking for a silver lining in the terrible recession numbers that we're reporting every day. And perhaps our partners, the New York Times, have come up with one for us, but it's not necessarily good news. Apparently, since the bailouts of the 1970s in Washington, there has grown up in the nation's capital an entire bailout industry consisting of lawyers, investors, William Seidman, who I referred to at the top of the hour, who used to run the Resolution Trust Corporation and the old savings and loan bailout. All these people are perfectly positioned to profit from the $700 billion being handed out by the U.S. Treasury these days. Joining us to talk about what and who constitutes this bailout industry in Washington is Eric Lipton, national reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
A lot of the names you cite in your article are very familiar names, including William Seidman from the old savings and loan crisis.
Yeah, there's quite a number of them that are signing up with ventures and which are sort of positioning themselves to profit from this downturn. And they clearly, people say that there are winners and there are losers. And those who know how the system works want to make sure that they're among the winners.
And Eric, what really surprises me about this article is that these guys sound like they're crowing about the opportunity here, not, you know, talking like we are here in America's time of crisis to help it through the dark times.
They are inundated with work right now, and some of them are actually sort of excited that this is a moment when what they do is really in the limelight, and they are so busy that they're working through the holidays to try to get deals done, like the IndyMac. The disposition of the IndyMac assets are going to be apparently announced today, and a number of these players are participating with the private equity funds that are going to apparently buy up what remains of that bank.
IndyMac, of course, a bank that failed long, long ago in, you know, relatively or the early days of this crisis. Can you describe how this deal happened? What kinds of deals are these people setting up? What do they look like? They take these assets, they package them in some way, and then sell them off to somebody else. You know, who's the buyer and who's the seller in this case?
There's a whole variety of ways that money could be made. During the savings and loan crisis of the early 1990s, most of the money was made by real estate assets that ended up in the hands of the government that then were resold to people like Sam Zell, the later newspaper guy, who would then resell the properties once the economy improved and make an enormous amount of money. That's going to be happening. But to a lesser extent, perhaps, than the savings and loan crisis, because the government has less of the actual real estate. Another way will be simply making money, helping banks get some of the bailout dollars from the federal government. There'll be lawyers that advise these banks, and that's happening with a number of the former players from the that worked for the federal government during the savings loan crisis are now advising banks on how they can get a piece of the $700 billion.
And this is a fee-based business for all of these consultants and lawyers. I'm wondering if people like Barney Frank and legislators in Washington have put any kind of limits on the kinds of fees that can be charged by these consultant types.
No, there aren't any limits on that. I mean, there are limits on executive compensation, but not on fees that you can pay to consultants.
I mean, Eric, it kind of sounds, the whole getup sounds a lot like the setup that got us into all this trouble to begin with.
I think it's different. I mean, I think that, you know, really, again, at any time there are winners and there are losers. And it's just that the people who know how the system works see the opportunity right now. And you know, when any time there's a fire sale, there are going to be bargains. And if you know how to buy at a fire sale, you're going to be better off than others. And those people who know how to buy are really getting ready to buy big right now.
Well, I guess part of what you're saying is that it's good there are facilitators here to get some of these assets out of the sort of dumpster and back into the market. And that's good for the financial sector. But have you noticed any apparent or potential conflicts of interest on the part of the kinds of individuals that are positioned to benefit so much?
And one of the things that is a little odd is that while most of these people, almost all of them, have been out of the government for more than the year or two that's required so that they don't have a legal conflict of interest, a number of them are going back to their former colleagues who still work with the federal government, calling them up and chatting with them about, well, when are you going to be letting this real estate go up for sale? And it just seems as if it's a pretty cozy relationship that they know personally the people that they used to work with, and now they're going to try to profit from that.
It's the way the world goes around in Washington. Eric Lipton is national reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, talking about the old faces in the new bailout.
For the third day, Israel has continued its offensive against Hamas targets in Gaza. More than 300 people have been killed, and we turn to Takrid El-Qadari, who's in Gaza City, reporting there for our partner, the New York Times. Welcome back, Takrid.
Yeah.
So describe to us what you've witnessed today.
Okay, since the morning, 35 Israeli airstrikes that hit Hamas facilities that are embedded within neighborhoods in Gaza City, in the entire Gaza Strip. This toll, as I mentioned earlier, I think it has increased, according to hospital sources, more than 310 are now dead, among them 17 children and 12 women, and more than 1,400 are now injured. That's the situation. People are in a state of fear and horror. They don't know what's coming. They are fearing an Israeli ground operation that Israel keeps talking about it and promoting for it. And I walked around the streets, and streets are deserted, shops are closed, grocery stores are still open, and they're providing some stuff, but you cannot find everything. Bakeries are still functioning, but they are fearing that there will be no fuel and no flour. And people are in a state of shock. They don't know what's coming. They don't know what are the targets. As I mentioned earlier, Hamas has been in power now in Gaza in complete control for a year and a half, and they've been in full control. They've been, you know, they have built a lot. They are living. You don't know who is wanted around you. If your neighbor is wanted, if someone living in your apartment building is wanted, you don't know where it's coming. You don't know what Israel is gonna hit. Who's the target at your neighborhood?
Tagrid, is there any sense among the people you talk to on the street that Hamas has maybe overplayed their hand by not continuing the ceasefire, that there may have been some sort of political misstep on the part of Hamas?
I think there is a risk here that Israel is taking and also Hamas is taking. For Hamas, this is how they negotiated with Israel through the mediators. We are willing for the truth, but in condition that for Israel, the conditions are for Israel to open the crossings. And the crossings is a demand by the people. People are dreaming for freedom of movement. They are stuck. They've been in jail in Gaza for a long time. For Israel also, it's a risk. You don't know what's coming. They tried this military option during the second intifada, but the result was the extreme line within Hamas won the elections, and Hamas made it to power. And now they are saying no to Hamas. We cannot negotiate with Hamas. They are considering Hamas an enemy. But with such pressure, with such psychological war, with such warfare, I think more extreme is coming, and I'm predicting the worst to come to Gaza.
At this point, is the greatest fear that ground troops will come in, and is there a sense among Palestinians that you've spoken to that despite Israel's claim that they do not want to occupy Gaza, is there a sense that that's what they do want to do amongst Palestinians?
I don't think Israel will occupy Gaza. What they are interested in, and it's clear from Israeli officials, they want to send a message to Hamas. And according to an Israeli official, I did an interview with him on the phone, the message is, we cannot negotiate with Hamas. They have to understand calm. They have to maintain the calm, and we will provide them with calm. Truth for a truth, and not a truth for opening the crossings and for them to succeed in governance in the Gaza Strip.
But what's the perception among Palestinians that you've spoken to today?
I went to the hospital today, and I met many people who are injured. And I spoke to them, and I said, so who do you blame? That's the question. And surprisingly, they didn't blame Hamas. I haven't heard the word Hamas today at the hospital. All these injured people, they were blaming Egypt, they were blaming Israel, the U.S., the international community. And I have not, and I'm talking about people in pain. And there was a mother who lost her loved one, her son, and he was in front of her, mm-hmm. dead body. And she was really like, cursing, the international community, the U.S. for their silence, the Arab countries, and Israel, but not Hamas.
Huh. That's
what I heard today in the hospital.
Tagrid,
from people who are in pain.
Tagrid, very interesting. Thank you so much for your report. Tagrid El-Qadari is in Gaza City, reporting there for our partners at the New York Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We don't want to dwell on the Detroit Lions 0-16 season.
Sure we do.
No, we don't. Anything they could do to follow that would be some kind of a comeback. But we wanted to ask you, what's a great comeback story? Because there's all kinds of comeback stories in sports. But what about politics? What about the celebrities?
I think one of the best comeback stories I can think about is the Vanessa Williams scandal from Miss America. And later on, she ended up singing for Disney's All the Colors in the Wind. And you sing with all the
voices of the mountain. Just Google Vanessa and find out how much trouble she got into in Miss America. That was, well, that's a big, serious comeback. Nancy emailed us with another great one. Four words, Marion Shepiloff Barry Jr. After his drug scandal in 1990, the deposed D.C. mayor became mayor again in 95. He's still in politics on the D.C. City Council. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Comebacks.
And New Orleans might fit into that category because they are trying to make a swift comeback after Katrina. And right now there's a contemporary art show underway that's called Prospect One. And by many accounts, it's been an enormous success, not only for the 80 artists involved from all over the world, but for the citizens of New Orleans and the hordes of tourists brought to the still battered and still recovering city. For a look at how the art show has brought good things to his city, we're joined by Lolas Eric Eli. He's a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. Lolas, welcome back.
It's my pleasure, Dora.
So what has made this art show so special for the city?
Well, part of what happened is that the show is an international exhibition, the best in contemporary art from around the world. But obviously, most local artists were not included, and that was not a part of the design. But the community has responded by creating auxiliary exhibit spaces so that local artists are also widely exhibited throughout the city. So it's become a far more participatory project than it might have been envisioned otherwise.
And it's spread all over the city, right? It's not like just in the French Quarter or just at Jackson Square. There are some parts of it that exist in the Ninth Ward, for example.
Exactly. Now, that was Dan Cameron's vision. He's the curator. And part of what he was trying to figure out is how the visual arts could contribute to the recovery of New Orleans. And by putting the exhibition throughout the city, it means, first of all, that tourists are forced to go beyond the usual confines of the Arts District and the French Quarter. But it also means that New Orleanians, who may not usually go to these other areas of the city, are forced to do the same thing. And I should say happily forced in this way.
Well, how does the visual art relate to what are very arresting visuals still in New Orleans from the aftermath of Katrina? And you know, Katrina or not, New Orleans has always been a memorable, outrageously visual city to begin with.
Well, there are a range of responses from the artists. Many of them are doing site-specific work. So you have, for example, the Noah's Ark kind of replica, which obviously has clear storm implications. You also have an artist who has created a kind of replica of a damaged home from the storm. But other aspects of the art are just the artist's vision that is not necessarily related to the storm per se. So it really is a range of work, giving you some sense both of the range of the city's experience and the range of contemporary art around the world.
And what's been the response? Are you measuring it by numbers, by excitement, by the psychological effect?
For me, I'm most interested in the prospects for long-term impact, in that certainly in the first few weeks, the number of people coming to see the exhibitions was incredible. Obviously, in an 11-week exhibition, that has waned to some extent, and my guess is that it will pick up again in the last week or so, particularly as New Orleanians realize that it's our last chance to go and see it. But what has happened that has been so amazing to me is that several spaces around the city have turned themselves into galleries to attract some of the Prospect One visitors. So there's an old furniture store, which was never reopened after the storm, that is now a major exhibition space. There's a huge middle school that, again, had not reopened since the storm. And that school, Colton Middle School, appears poised to be a kind of artist collective with exhibit spaces for dozens of artists.
That's a beautiful story, Lolas. And I guess this is a hard question to ask, but you're the best person to ask it, I think. You know, we in New York and other places around the country think of repair from something like Katrina as a complete whitewash, a complete sort of redevelopment where the evidence of what happened is obliterated. It seems to me that New Orleans, which has carried so much of its history visually in every street and alley, is going to also on some level preserve the Katrina moment in a way that doesn't erase it.
Well, it's crucial that that remain in our memory, because in many ways the threat implicit in Katrina is ongoing. The failure of the federal levees, the loss of the wetlands, those kinds of problems still threaten us. So we got to keep that as part of our psyche and figure out how to get beyond it.
And the exhibit goes through January 18th. Lolas, always a great pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Lolas Eric Eli is a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. He's also the co-director of a new documentary film called Faubourg Tremé. It's about the civil rights movement of the 1800s and the lessons of that era that are being relearned in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Now we have headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Israel's foreign minister says that there was no alternative to its attack on Gaza. They're now in the third day of the attacks, and over 300 people are dead so far. The Bush administration has blamed the violence on Hamas. The group broke a truce by firing rockets deep into Israeli territory. Many Arab leaders have condemned the aggressive counterattacks by Israel. Law enforcement groups are crediting better training for a drop in police officer deaths. The numbers killed in the line of duty this year is down more than 20%. About half the deaths this year are traffic-related, and it's the 11th consecutive year in which traffic incidents were the leading cause of death. Another study shows the number of African-American men killed in gun crimes has gone up dramatically. Criminologists at Northeastern University found a 40% increase since the year 2000. The number of people who committed fatal shootings has also gone up, and the study puts some blame on the Bush administration for cutting grants to local police and juvenile crime prevention programs. Some Detroit Lions fans wore shirts yesterday that said "A Making History 0-16, and their historic prediction came true. The team is the first in NFL history to finish the year with a no-win record. Mike Stone is a Detroit sportscaster and a season ticket holder for the Lions. He was not impressed by his team's performance.
Unbelievable in a league that's almost impossible to do this, and obviously nobody's done it before, that thrives on parity, that a team can be this pathetic.
Shame. The Detroit Lions lost to the Green Bay Packers 31-21, but they did inspire our question for this morning, which is what, Adora?
Comebacks.
You had to think there for a moment.
Well, I was thinking about, it was so harsh to call them so pathetic.
Well, that was a
fan.
I was
still back. I know you're still back, but boy, fans are tough.
And a season ticket holder.
They had a tough time. Detroit's been through a lot. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, certainly no one would argue with the idea that 2008 has been a stressful year. And if you're just talking about economic news, Stress has, I think been a story since last March when things really started to tank in the subprime.
Or even before that for some people.
Well, I mean, whether you're talking about your own mortgage or your investments or, you know, this stress is increasingly trackable in the brain because brain science is improving. And our ability to track phenomena in the brain means we can actually see the stress and psychological consequences of things even as large as and intractable as, a financial meltdown. And joining us to talk about how brain science and economics might actually come together in some way is Dr. Gregory Burns, who's director of the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University, and he joins us from Atlanta. Dr. Burns, thanks for being a part of the program.
Great to be here.
How do you track economic stress in the brain, and what might we theorize about the consequences for people's brains in this crazy economic meltdown?
Great question. The way we do this is part of a new field called neuroeconomics, which is about 4 or 5 years old. And the basic technology is we have people go inside an MRI scanner and have them make actual decision-making tasks while we scan their brains. And essentially what we do is track blood flow changes and see exactly which parts of the brain are changing activity as a person makes decisions. And so it's kind of like decoding the genome, except it's actually much more difficult. It's like decoding how the brain works.
And scientifically, it's interesting to know about this stuff, but does it suggest any approaches that we might take to, say, a job interview or, you know, hearing our boss tell us that, you know, goodbye, you know, we can't use you anymore?
I think it does. I think we're just at the beginning of that. So there's a couple of theories about how we make decisions. And one of the threads that's emerging out of the field of neuroeconomics is that specific circuits in the brain that we use for, say, gauging the pleasure that we expect to get out of something, or conversely, the amount of pain or loss that we anticipate, are actually the same types of circuits that are used in different things. It turns out the brain probably evolved to process all sorts of stimuli in the environment, both good and bad, that are typically associated with essentially primary things like food and drink, but also pain. And so when it comes to stress and anxiety and fear, these functions actually co-opt parts of the brain that function in terms of pain. So when you're fearful or anxious, it's literally using the same parts of the brain that you would use when you're afraid of, you know, pricking your finger on a needle.
Or wolves or bears and dinosaurs and stuff.
Well, I remind you that people weren't around when dinosaurs walked the earth.
My kids will tell me that when I get
But just in terms of measuring this, Dr. Burns, it's interesting that you see survey and study after survey and study showing that women in this economic environment tend to be more stressed out about money issues than men. So when you're taking a look at the brain and how it's being affected by the current situation, women really have women's brains might tell you more.
It's possible, although interestingly, you know, when we start peering inside the brain, it's really difficult to tell the difference between a male and a female brain.
Huh.
And, you know, as I point out, you don't need a brain scan to tell the difference. The difference between genders and even age-related effects is swamped by differences between individuals. So one thing that we actually see is when people make economic decisions and there's the possibility of losing money, that we see a lot of activity in parts of the brain associated with pain. And one thing that we know about the pain system of the brain is that it's like the brain simulates it in advance. So it turns out that when you step on a tack, you see all sorts of things lighting up in the brain associated with your foot, as well as emotional areas. But what's interesting about it is you also see the same sorts of activity even if you start thinking about stepping on a tack.
Really?
And you start anticipating it. And this is where I think it becomes very relevant for economic decision making, because when you're anticipating something bad, whether it's rational or irrational doesn't really matter. The point is you start ramping up activity in these fear and pain circuits. And that fundamentally causes a type of decision-making associated with pulling back and retreat.
And some of that is evident to people. I mean, you're reminding me of a time when I lost a job and a psychiatrist told me at one point after I'd had terribly no success in getting reemployed that, in fact, it's probably a bad idea to do job interviews at a time when you are really stressed and really anxious, because the people can sense your desperation and they kind of go, why would we want this person? He's desperate for a job. And I thought that was a really fascinating insight, but it sounds like you can actually even measure some of that stuff.
Yeah, and some of the experiments that we've done show that there are clearly different types of people, you know, whether it's the state of mind at the time they do the scan or whether they're just fundamentally different all the time. You can see differences in essentially the rate that activity ramps up in these fear and pain circuits well in advance of the thing that people are afraid of. And, you know, we kind of categorize them into essentially procrastinators and extreme dreaders, the worry warts. And what's interesting is that the worry warts, you know, ramp up this activity in the brain, and that, you know, takes energy. It takes energy away from what I would call good decision making.
And so the consequence at the very least of this economic downturn is that people's decisions are going to be bathed in stress, that we need to deal with the stress as much as we deal with all the other economic consequences. It's something that is true on a broad scale as well as individually. It sounds like what you're saying.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, unfortunately, it's kind of a positive feedback loop, you know, where the more people that are stressed around you, it just kind of feeds into the phenomena and tends to run away.
We're all in this together, Dr. Gregory Burns. He's the director of the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University and is the author of Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So the takeaway there is don't hang around people who are focused on the economic downturn. Great. So newsrooms are out, including Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Yeah, don't hang around me. Good morning. Wall Street is open for business. The Dow is up around about 5, maybe 6 points. And the S&P is down not even quite 1 point. Israel continues its assault against Hamas and the Gaza Strip for the third straight day. Defense Minister Ehud Barak said yesterday on CNN that they won't let up.
We will use our force as forcefully as needed against the Hamas in order to achieve a change in its behavior.
Israel's targets today included the Hamas premier's home and a building at a university with ties to the group. The death toll has risen to at least 315 people. A Chinese trial for 9 people connected with the tainted milk scandal opened today. They're charged with producing and selling melamine. The trial for 6 others began on Friday, and the tainted formula killed 6 children and sickened hundreds of thousands of others. Somali President Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed has resigned after 4 years in power. He'd come under increasing pressure to do so since he fired one of his prime ministers, and that was almost 2 weeks ago. Let's look at some stories and making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, if Dallas is America's team, then woe is America.
It's fumbled. It is picked up. Running with the football is Chris Clemens. 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 5, touchdown!
Ouch. Yes, that Chris Clemens fumble, it was picked up from Tony Romo, gave the Phillies a 34-3 lead. They went on to win by even more than that. The Dallas Cowboys are out of the playoffs. The Philadelphia Eagles are in the playoffs. Jeff Beresford, how we got a few minutes to talk NFL sports after a really fabulous weekend. Jeff, let's talk about 3 things. The Dallas Cowboys are out. The Patriots are out. The Jets are out because of the complex NFL math. The NFL can't be happy about that, but the Dolphins are in. What a comeback story.
The Dolphins are in, and it's spectacular, although ESPN is reporting that the Dolphins may well lose Bill Parcells, who is now stands alone as the greatest turnaround expert in the NFL. And it remains to be seen whether they can continue their success without him.
Bill Clinton thinks he's the comeback kid, but it's actually Bill Parcells. Well, there were a lot of really interesting games yesterday. You know, how do you see the playoffs?
The New York Giants look just spectacular to me. It's the Plaxico Burress thing is going to hurt them, but their offensive and defensive lines, their overall schemes, they're a brilliant team, and I like them to repeat.
What about the Colts? 9-0. They've got a real streak going coming into the playoffs.
The Colts look great. I laid them off as done earlier in the season, and that turns out to have been wrong. I still don't believe in their defense. I don't think they can go all the way.
What about the Philadelphia Eagles? I mean, they stomped on the Dallas Cowboys yesterday. I mean, as entertaining as that was for a Cowboy hater like myself, did the Eagles have a chance?
Yeah, they really do. They look dominant. Although, you know, the way Dallas imploded, it's hard to get a line on how good the Eagles really
right.
were. It's when a team falls apart like that, it feeds on itself. And the Eagles revealed a lot of weaknesses during the season. You just don't know whether that game against Dallas was indicative of what they can do.
Well, the playoffs are about great stories. McNabb's a great story. I've already mentioned the Dolphins are a great story coming back from the worst record in football last year. What about the San Diego Chargers?
Well, Phillip Rivers just looked awesome last night, didn't he? I mean, he's the hottest quarterback in football right now, with apologies to Manning. He looked like he could beat anybody. And the Chargers, to me, are a team to look out for in the playoffs.
And he's fun to watch. Let's talk MVP before we go. Some people were saying that because of the turnaround, and I keep harping on the Dolphins, it's a Pennington. That ought to get the MVP. The favorite, of course, is Manning at Indianapolis. So what do you think?
I like Manning. I mean, he dragged a team that had fallen apart and was missing most of their key players, and with a shaky defense, and he carried them on his back all the way into the postseason and a spectacular finish. I mean, the man is just, we watched a great athlete in his prime this year.
And Detroit, Jeff?
Detroit, all right.
A word about Detroit, very quickly?
A little perspective about Detroit. Every league, every year that plays more games has a team that loses 15 or 16 games in a row. It's kind of surprising it took so long to happen in the NFL.
All right. So positive thought from Jeff Beresford Howe for Detroit, 0-16. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay.
Our sports guy from Oakland, California, Jeff Beresford Howe.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 29th. Femi Okeh has just joined us with the headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Some Hamas landmarks in Gaza are now piles of rubble. New Israeli airstrikes knocked out some Hamas symbols, including a security compound and a university building. More than 300 Palestinians are dead. A ground assault could be next, and so far Hamas rocket attacks have slowed but not stopped. Winter weather will cause trouble across the country today. There could be some big floods in the Midwest once warm temperatures melt last week's snow and ice. Winter storm warnings are in effect in the northwest, and this force of nature is causing some major problems. Sounds like our stomachs before breakfast time, but no.
Podcast moment. There
it's,
was
it's wind.
It's,
oh, it's not, no, I thought it was. Not, I thought cold immediately.
Personal wind.
Freezing.
It's nature's wind. Okay, so let me continue with the story. It's just such a great piece of sound. I had to share that with you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed sharing my wind. In Michigan, wind damage has hundreds of thousands without power. Nearly 200,000 homes and businesses around Michigan remain in the dark after strong winds associated with a cold front blew through yesterday. And that's a look at your main stories for now.
Exclusive wind coverage on The Takeaway from Femi. Okay, thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Femi, and thank you, John. So what will 2000...
Or shut up.
What will 2009 bring? What will it bring? We've been asking ourselves that a lot here at The Takeaway, and that means, of course, we've been asking a lot of our friends and contributors to The Takeaway. For what's happening or what we should look to be happening in Hollywood, we turn to author Sharon Waxman. She's the editor-in-chief of the blog, therapnews.com, and she joins us from Santa Monica. Sharon, clearly percolating here is a potential strike at the Screen Actors Guild. What are some of the issues on the table, and what's the timeline here?
Yeah, all of Hollywood is on edge at the moment as the year draws to a close and looking ahead at 2009, because there is a very real possibility that the entertainment industry could be on strike for the second time in a year. And it's over the very same issues that the Writers Guild was battling the studios over last year, which has to do with the money that is earned off of internet distribution of television shows and movies. So basically, to just break it down very in a basic way, the actors want more money from the money that is earned off of internet sales, which is maybe it could be downloads or can be sales that just take place on other kinds of streaming platforms. But the studios say, well, they don't make enough money on their movies and television shows to begin with because the marketing is so expensive and the margins are so tight and that nobody's really figured out how we make money off the internet anyway, and it's premature.
Is it fair to say that there's a real split in the guild as to those who are supporting the notion of a strike and those who are not?
Oh, yeah. There's a huge split in the guild right now, and that's one of the main reasons that we don't actually know as we head into the new year whether SAG is going to even have the authorization from its own members to go on strike. But you have these two rival lists, these petitions that are going around, and you have major actors like George Clooney who have signed petitions saying, no, we do not want to strike at this time. The economy's in terrible condition. We should just take they didn't say we should take the deal that's being offered by the studios, which is a package of $250 million. But they are saying this is not the right time to strike. And then you've got a much more activist bloc, which the guild says is bigger than the other one, but, you know, who knows? And that's people like it's Mel Gibson and Ed Asner who have signed that list. So you've got dueling petitions right now.
So they're going to start off the new year with some very serious issues on the table about 2009 and into the future. But there's certainly some other trends that you've noticed that we can be looking to next year. Let's talk about independent studios. This time next year, are there going to be any left?
That's a really good question. Independent studios have been struggling terribly this year. And again, this has to do with this huge seismic change that's going on in the media and the entertainment industries as a whole. We've seen it already with the music industry, which I described yesterday to a friend as already melted in a puddle on the floor, while the movie industry and TV industries are just icebergs that are just starting to trickle. So what we're going to see is more struggling to figure out how to get movies, particularly independent movies, in front of people who want to see those movies because the theaters aren't really carrying them anymore. Or when they carry them for a week or 2 weeks. It's really hard to get a toehold in theaters where you need to build word of mouth, and that takes time. And there's too many movies, and this has been building up over years, you know, since the whole trend of Sundance becoming a huge cultural event and everybody picking up a video camera, making their own film. Well, now there's too many of those films, and there's all these little distributors that aren't able to make it. So Bob Yari's company, which made Crash, which was the Oscar winner, Best Picture, just declared bankruptcy. And there's a lot of companies that are tearing. Harvey Weinstein's company, the Weinstein Company. There's all these reports of credit problems there. So independent distribution is undergoing big changes, and we'll have to wait and see which companies can survive.
And you mentioned the credit crunch. I mean, clearly it couldn't have come at a worse time for independent studios who are already struggling to gain traction.
Right. We should actually talk about the biggest independent studio, which is DreamWorks. DreamWorks, you know, which was bought by Paramount 3 years ago, is now heading off on its own. That relationship didn't work out very well. They make about 6 to 10 movies a year. They just found financing from this huge Indian media conglomerate called Reliance to raise over $1 billion to allow them to kind of leave Paramount, take their projects with them, let Steven Spielberg do what he wants to do. And they're having trouble raising the rest of the money. In other words, they have a certain amount of money that this Indian company is putting into the production for them, to their capitalization, but they have to go out and raise about another $700 million. And in the current climate, that's very hard to do.
I mean, they're about a quarter of a billion short, right?
There's a whole lot of spin going on at the moment. But right now, Steven Spielberg himself is floating the company. And apparently Reliance is going to help put in some money so they can buy these projects from Paramount that they have to do by the middle of January. This has a really big impact, serious consequences for the kinds of movies that they're going to be able to make. So, for example, Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson are supposed to be making Tintin, you know, the adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Huge 3D, $130 million project, and it's probably a low estimate is my guess. They have to have the money to do that. And that this is not a theoretical question. This will be whether that movie goes forward or not, whether they can raise a lot of money in a really difficult fundraising climate.
And with Spielberg bankrolling his own company, DreamWorks, I mean, the whole Madoff scandal can't be anything but a gigantic headache because half of Hollywood seems to be involved in that in some way, or at least involved in the losses.
There are absolutely big Hollywood figures who are involved with Madoff and Katzenberg. Jeffrey Katzenberg from DreamWorks Animation, Steven Spielberg's partner in founding DreamWorks, is one of them. I don't believe that we've learned that Steven Spielberg personally invested with him, but his charities have, which is, you know, worse. And so pretty much all of the big media moguls and the big Hollywood have really been hit very hard this year. The Madoff scandal is one aspect, but just the way the stock market has dropped so dramatically has had also a really big impact on the personal fortunes of a lot of people in Hollywood.
From your experience, and you know Hollywood really well, Sharon, do you think that these are just temporary setbacks given the economic climate, or are these just trends that are indicative of what's happening to content-driven material that Hollywood produces?
I think you've got two different trends going on, and so you have to look at them slightly separately, but together at the moment, they're creating a really bad cocktail, actually. But one is the transformation of the media landscape in terms of how people use media, how they consume it. That's everything we know about people going to the internet more and watching TV less, people using TiVo, which is affecting what advertisers want to spend on advertising. It has to do with newspapers struggling to keep readers and to keep advertisers. And the movie industry, for the moment, has been more or less, the big studios have felt more or less intact. But the change is really coming for those guys, too. Look at television with NBC just moving Jay Leno into the 10 p.m. primetime hour. These are really big changes that are just the beginning of the kinds of transformational changes I think we're going to see, not just this year, but over, say, the next 5 years. You have to combine that with the sort of really unprecedented economic situation that we're in at the moment that makes everything kind of more difficult. And so those two things together, I think, create an unusual period of uncertainty and anxiety for the entertainment industry. Combine that with a strike just makes it even more kind of murky. But basically, for the moment, people still go to the movies. It's not like the car industry. People are going. They want right. to be entertained. No, seriously, yeah. because that is still a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of change and the feeling that change is out there, they don't know what it is sort of really a cloud that sort of hangs over everything.
Thanks, Sharon. Sharon Waxman is an editor. She is also the editor, and she is an author, and she's also the editor-in-chief of the blog, therapnews.com, an entertainment and media news website, which is launching next month.
Hollywood loves a comeback story, but it probably doesn't like starring in its own comeback story. What's a good comeback? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I spoke to them and I said, who do you blame? That's the question. Surprisingly, they didn't blame Hamas. I haven't heard the word Hamas today at the hospital. All these injured people, they were blaming Egypt, they were blaming Israel, the U.S., the international community.
Your takeaway comes from Tigrid El-Khodri, reporting for the New York Times in Gaza on the unrest there. We're always on. If you miss anything, take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.